Good evening, it's just on 7 o'clock and you're tuned to Panacea on 107.3 to SER. This is your half an hour of health programme every Tuesday night. I'm Quentin Strawley and tonight we're going to be looking at broken heart. Yes, there's actually a syndrome called broken heart. Also, we look at the carbon footprint of meat consumption, how we go about effective muscle building, and we listen to the music of the beat of your heart. So, lots to listen to over the next half hour.
1917, the Great Strike, marks the centenary of one of Australia's largest industrial conflicts with a six-week-long exhibition at Carriage Works. The multimedia exhibition features large-scale historical images, moving footage, oral history excerpts, and music and poetry alongside commissioned artworks to tell the story of a movement that started in the old Everleigh Railway workshops. Produced by the City of Sydney and Carriage Works, the free exhibition runs until August 27. For more information, visit whatson.sydney and search for Great Strike.
Sponsors of 2SER.
Now, there's research on amino acids, particularly when it comes to protein uptake. And let's turn to a regular contributor, Russell Setright, who's a practicing naturopath in New South Wales. Russell, tell us all about these findings when it comes to getting the protein in and getting the muscle built.
Look, I think, Quentin, it's a very interesting one because there's a lot of people who partake in supplements of protein and also supplements of amino acids in an endeavour to improve sporting performance and muscle mass. And it's laughed at by a lot of people as a waste of time. But, you know, we've got to look into it and say, well, we might laugh at it because we look at the Arnold Schwarzenegger beside us and we think, well, muscle-bound freak, we don't want to be like that. But then again, do we or don't we? Well, I don't know. But do they work? Yes, they do. And how do they work? I think we've got to look at what you're taking. I think many of the ones out there, you're probably just as well beating up an egg and putting some powdered milk with it and getting close to it.
Right.
But what they found is the branched-chain amino acids, which you can get in supplements, certainly have shown improved muscle mass. Now, but then they looked at these more closely and they said if you take them without a good protein meal as well, and a good protein meal would be something like egg whites. That's an ideal protein meal.
Right.
If you're having a protein meal and taking branched-chain amino acid supplements, they statistically significantly increase the amount of muscle mass by if the energy of the taking in that protein is stored as muscle rather than fat.
That seems a safer way of doing it as well.
It is. And, look, you know, it's all very well for us to say, oh, you know, they're just taking supplements, they're wasting their money, but you know, I'll tell you what, a slab of steak's not all that cheap either. So I don't know if they are wasting their money. If they're getting natural protein that's derived from eggs and casein and it's got vitamins and minerals, they're getting a good source of food, which, of course, all stems from the hospital days of when they used it for feeding people who couldn't eat with nasogastric feeds. I mean, that's where they first developed these things from.
Right.
And then they moved into the supplement industry where people, you know, didn't eat that amount of food and they could supplement with extra protein in between their meals to give them that extra because they were wanting to build muscle mass. And then the studies have shown that it does. Now, creatine monohydrate has been shown to improve performance as well in the clinical studies. So the evidence is there, but what I would encourage people is not just to read the hype so much in all the different types, but have a look up in the reputable literature like Medline.
Yeah.
Look up the branched chain amino acids and protein and muscle mass building, and it'll give you what you need to take. And you may save a little bit of money in doing that, but at least you know what you're doing is, in fact, going to work. Because if you go and see your naturopath, your healthcare provider as well, they will be able to give you guidance that way. Probably not so much your medical practitioner, and that's sad me saying that, because they don't study nutrition to that degree. So, and it's not having a shot at them in any way. It's just saying, well, if you don't study it, you probably don't understand the mechanism and why bother learning it when you're busy doing other things. So I think that, you know, there are a lot of people in sport, a lot of people who want to look at muscle mass. As you get older, if you increase the protein, you help improve the muscle strength and maintain muscle mass, which is vitally important for older people to help prevent falling over. So it's not just if you want to be a bodybuilder, it's also maintaining muscles through your life as well. And I think these branched-chain amino acids can be of benefit as a supplement, along with the correct amount of protein. And don't forget your vitamin D, which, you know, because it's not just the bodybuilder, it's also the person as they're getting older. And we're looking at old now, as probably going into the 90s, but we're looking at when you may need supplementation and looking at is in your 50s.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, as we're living longer, we're saying, well, that's now old, so that's when we need to do it. No, you need to start doing it in your 50s to help prevent that loss occurring and reduce the amount of that loss. And the evidence is quite strong that you can do that, and that will improve your strength, your balance, and lessen the chances of falls and breaking bones, which, of course, can be... fatal.
Well, you talk about bone breakage, but of course, people talk about the light load bearing is essential to, in around about the 50s and 60s anyway, to keep your actual your bones stronger.
That's it, and that's the next thing I was going to add to that too. Along with your protein and your branched-chain amino acids and your vitamin D, weight bearing exercises are very, very important. They set in place in your body, let's build more strength in bones and muscles, rather than let them go down. If the astronauts, when they first started to do space travel, suffered massive muscle loss and bone loss as a result of that. They then developed the exercise programs that actually gave them lifting and weight-bearing exercises to maintain that. You only need to spend a few weeks in bed and you will lose muscle mass and a bit of bone loss. So it's very important that we maintain not only the nutritional side, but also the weight-bearing exercise side. And if we do that, we can maintain our strength and our mass, not the same as it was when we were 20, but certainly a lot better than it would be if we don't do that type of program.
Wow, great advice. Russell, as a practicing naturopath in New South Wales, Russell Setright, you have a really great week, and we'll catch up next.
Thanks very much, Quentin. All the very best.
I'm Nick Healy, host of Breakfast here on 2SER. I'm going to be helping Newtown Neighbourhood Centre create the Newtopian dream. On August 29, I'll be sleeping out in Newtown Square and fundraising to support homelessness services. And the next morning, you can hear stories live from the square throughout breakfast. So support Newtown Neighbourhood Centre. Head to 2SER.com and sponsor the Newtopian Dream. 2SER is a proud supporter of the Newtown Neighbourhood Centre.
Now, we often refer to people dying of a broken heart. And we often think it's more of a metaphor. But in fact, there's been research being done by Nana Dawson from the University of Aberdeen. And here she is talking to Mark Porter from the BBC.
People die within a few days of experiencing a strong emotion that makes them feel as if they've had a heart attack. And that can be the loss of a partner, the loss of a very good friend. Many other losses can cause this, for example, a financial loss.
Now, listeners may be saying, well, I knew that. People die of a broken heart when their spouse dies after 50 years of marriage. But have we got hard medical evidence that that's happening?
We do now. Had you asked me this question 15 years ago, we would have laughed at each other. But now we do have that evidence indeed, because we know that these people do not have a heart attack. They think they have a heart attack. The paramedics who come to pick them up think that they've got a heart attack. We, the medical professionals, think that they've got a heart attack until we gather a bit of evidence with the investigations that we do in the hospital as an emergency. And when we see that the heart arteries are clear, are unobstructed, but the heart muscle takes a particular shape of an octopus fishing pot, which in Japan is called a takotsubo, that is when we know that they've got a broken heart.
My name is Dr. Alexander Lyon. I'm a consultant cardiologist at the Royal Brompton Hospital and a senior lecturer at Imperial College in London. I have a specialist interest in Takotsubo syndrome. The vast majority of people who experience Takotsubo have either had a background of chronic stress and there's then a final tipping point, or they may be absolutely fine and out of the blue an event happens, either a tragedy like the loss of a loved one or maybe winning the lottery, and a high emotional experience. But the linking fact is a huge adrenaline surge.
My name is Ken Glass. I just got back into playing football after Christmas because I wanted to get fit again. Roped my mate Dave into coming along. We were playing football for a couple of hours. I got a knock on the head and suffered a concussion on the back of that. I got Dave to drive my car to the hospital, but within 5 minutes, I collapsed in the chair. My heart stopped, virtually mid-sentence. Thankfully, Dave, with his quick response, dragging me out of the car and commencing CPR, that ultimately saved my life.
The common thread is a very high surge of adrenaline in the body. Now, we understand from the textbooks and from medical school that adrenaline's a stimulant. So when we're playing tennis or running around, the heart beats harder and faster. But our research at Imperial College showed that if you go to the extreme levels of adrenaline, actually the muscle starts to shut down. And rather than pumping harder and faster, it slows down and even paralyses. And this is what we see in these patients with Takotsubo syndrome.
Dave was doing CPR for about 20 minutes until the ambulance arrived. Was given 5 shocks from the defib on the ground there, and that didn't work. 2 more shocks in the back of the ambulance and started my heart again. Initially, they assumed it was a massive heart attack, and that's what they were treating me for. It was only after an ultrasonic scan of my heart they were able to see the Takotsubo. One ventricle ballooned out, not contracting, the way a jellyfish would swim.
This is probably the strongest mind-to-body interaction that we have ever seen in medicine. The heart becomes almost perplexed. It's almost as if your brain has heard these news, and the heart suffers as a consequence, and it's perplexed, and it cannot move, it cannot function. In fact, it does almost nothing. It's quite frightening even for medical professionals to see that, because it's so acute, it's so sudden, it's so dramatic. And you've just seen that the heart arteries are normal, and you can't possibly explain it to yourself for a few moments in your head, and then the penny drops, that is a broken heart.
How common is this?
We thought it was rare. We thought it was a curiosity that one only sees once in their medical professional career. It's not like that at all.
And what about those who do make an apparent recovery? Is there likely to be some long-term lingering damage, or can they get this again?
When I see people in the clinic to discuss the future, it very much depends on the past and what's happened to them. Have they had previous episodes? Was this a one-off? What was the trigger? If the trigger was a unique event in their life, it may never happen again. I tend to quote about 10% of people have a recurrence in the future. We see that most people who we look after can make a great recovery and do very well.
With regards to my heart, there's no damage, there's no pathology. Before leaving hospital, they fitted me with a defibrillator, sitting there and monitoring my heart regularly. The assumption is that I'll just continue to go about my daily business.
That was Care of the BBC, and Mark Porter brought that to you, that report.
What have you always wondered about Sydney and the people who call it home? 2SER is Seeking Sydney. Head over to 2ser.com and ask the questions you want our team to investigate. While you're there, why not vote for whichever question you'd like answered? 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
The conversation around meat consumption tends to be an ethical discussion around the welfare and rights of animals. You might have a vegan or vegetarian friend who won't stop talking about their dietary intake every time you have lunch, but you might not have heard about how bad your dinner time steak or burger is for the environment. This report, care of Miles Herbert, talking to Julie Freelander from the University of Technology.
We have to really unpack and separate the issues, because there are a number of issues involved with meat production and consumption. And of course, people who talk about animal welfare and animal rights will say no meat at all, which is, of course, fair enough. If you're talking about meat reduction, that's not necessarily as big an issue. If you're talking about health, that's another issue. If you're talking about environment, it's another issue. They're all connected to meat production and consumption. In terms of the environment, Meat production has an impact on not just greenhouse gases and climate change, but also water use, things like use of phosphorus, which is a finite resource, concepts like biodiversity and land degradation. Everybody thinks about climate change. They think about enteric gases or fluffs or whatever that come from cows' supposed backsides. In actual fact, that's a bit of a furphy. They burp. But cows and other ruminant animals basically create a lot of methane. And methane is a greenhouse gas, and it's stronger and more powerful than carbon dioxide.
And that methane gas adds to the warming of the planet?
It does. So there was a study that came out from the UN in the 2000s, and it basically said that livestock were responsible for 18% of all global greenhouse gases. So in Australia, the number isn't as high. So it depends. It's not exactly 100% sure, but it's around 10%, which is still substantial.
What about the industrial side of it? Besides producing methane, does the transportation and the commercial side of the meat industry play into climate change?
So there are some studies that actually put that 80% figure as very low. And once you start factoring in all those other aspects, then yes, it can be even higher. So, of course, people like to debate all those figures, and that respect it becomes contentious. But I think it's important to know that if you put it in perspective, they say that livestock production basically is similar to all transportation. So it's still very substantial.
And bovine animals like cows that are traditionally a part of the meat industry, they use a lot of water, don't they?
In terms of water consumption and how much livestock actually consumes in the process of the production, again, it's quite contentious in terms of it depends how the cows are being raised or the sheep or whatever. Suffice to say that it's still substantial. And what I suppose a lot of researchers like to say is if you compare, say, animal protein to non-animal protein, then non-animal protein is going to consume far less water. And I think that's something to be really aware of, is to continually compare livestock, as in ruminant animals, which consists of cows and sheep, to non-ruminant animals and also non-animal proteins.
I think it's fair to say that climate change is getting worse and probably will continue to get worse. So a lot of places around the world have less water?
Well, I think a really key thing to think about is that the population of the world is increasing. So, for example, people in India and China, they want to eat what people in Australia and America and Europe want to eat in many ways due to cultural influences and other things that we probably could discuss as well as to why people eat meat. But because of that, the consumption of meat is increasing in countries like India and China. And so we have to think about population and how it's increasing and what's happening in these other countries and the projections of eating meat as well.
So meat consumption, or maybe just the amount of meat we eat, is a Western concept?
So I think if you look back over, say, a few generations, we realise that the way that people eat today, or the way perhaps our parents ate, is very different to how their parents and their grandparents ate. So meat used to be very special. It was something that people perhaps ate a few times a week. If you think about animals and how they're raised, even the biblical sense of, for example, the sacrificial lamb, that's what it was. It was a sacrifice. It was regarded as something that was special. So people have grown used to eating a lot of meat, more so than perhaps ever before. So again, what is it associated with? People associate it with religious, cultural, health, all those things. I think we have to, again, unpack all those and realise that for many people it's too much of a good thing.
So we're eating too much meat.
We are still eating too much meat. So I mentioned earlier that people in developing countries are eating more red meat. There has been a really terrific study. It was produced by The Lancet, and they said that in order for equity, if there's such a concept of equity and red meat, but in order for equity, then people in developing countries basically should be allowed to eat more, and people in developed countries should be therefore eating less. And they call that contraction and convergence. So if you then look at what they recommend as to what people here, for example, should be eating, men are eating probably at least double the amount that they should be. If you really start thinking about how meat is consumed, it's now practically in everything. I often think, you know, when I'm served a meal, how often pork might be part of a dish, or it seemingly can never just be a regular sandwich. It has to have meat inside it. So people aren't just eating meat at night time. They're eating meat for breakfast. They're eating meat for lunch, etc.
You know, we think about cars, right? We think about greenhouse gas emissions through our automobiles. We think about plastics. We think about all these things, but I think rarely do we think about the bacon we eat for breakfast as being what you call an environmental burden.
I think there's a number of possible explanations. Firstly, I think that people have a real problem dealing with the environment as an issue. I think that my own personal theory, well, my theory born of research, is that when people read about bad news or difficult subjects or topics in newspapers, and they do, there's a certain distance. They call it the emotional distance. But when it comes to the environment, quite often it's so overwhelming because people think, oh my God, it's part of where I am now. I can't cope. And so therefore that creates all those things like denial, etc. Because if you actually eat less red meat, you are helping the environment. A lot of the meat reduction campaigns, I think, basically tacitly acknowledge that the environmental frame or message is difficult, and they'll often then focus on the health message or the animal welfare message. But for whatever reason, it really makes sense to eat less meat and less red meat in particular to help the environment. In terms of also why we don't read about it as much, so newspapers and traditional news media are very much influenced by political and economic influences. So you know, it's a commercial exercise. You have very powerful lobby groups who are constantly presenting their message. So if you think of news as reflecting public relations, which basically means commercial, industrial, whatever, that might partly explain it.
So our newspapers and our politicians are run by big meat?
There's no doubt that livestock production and consumption in Australia plays a really big role in our industry, in our commerce, in our culture. A lot of people have a vested interest in that. It's a very difficult to extricate. I guess pointing the finger of blame doesn't really help. It's really a matter of trying to understand where people are coming from and explaining that, number one, their health is going to benefit, the environment's going to benefit. We can move to other industries that can assist as well. It doesn't have to just rely on meat.
Does everyone have to be a vegetarian to help out?
Absolutely not. So I was actually going to refer to a study that was done only 2016. And what they did was they looked at business as usual or diet as usual, and they projected towards 2050. And they basically found that if we actually adhered to health guidelines, then which means eating a bit less red meat, it means that we could actually avoid 5 million premature deaths by 2050.
That report care of Miles Herbert, talking to Julie Friedlander from UTS.
Cancel the dinner plans, call off the wedding and free up your September schedule because the Sydney Fringe Festival opens in 2 weeks. Why not kickstart your Fringe adventure with the otherworldly delights of the opening party, Fringe Ignite, at Kensington Street Precinct, Chippendale, September 2. Check out this year's incredible lineup of shows and book your tickets now at sydneyfringe.com. 2SER is a proud media partner of Sydney Fringe Festival.
There's a lot of evidence around how music affects our body and soul. But have you ever thought about how your body and soul can affect the music? Artist and UNSW lecturer George Klutt. Installation at the UTS Gallery applies biofeedback technique to listen to your heartbeat and use it to make a unique soundscape.
This is a pulse oximeter. It's a kind you use in hospital, and we've adapted this. It comes with a very specialised circuit that analyses the amount of light being absorbed and reflected in your finger, and that changes every time you're blood whooshes through the tip of your finger.
Will it hurt?
It won't hurt at all. So there's no nasty surprises in this artwork.
Okay.
So just put that on your finger and rest that down on the table.
Great.
So now we're going to start hearing the sound of your heartbeat. And we're listening to a soundscape that I've designed with Gail Priest. So usually in the gallery, people are hearing this through headphones. It's a very private, intimate experience, and I've got two headphones so you can listen with your friend. But essentially you're exploring this state inside your body and some feelings and how they can shift the sounds.
You mentioned you were working with a soundscape, so this isn't just the sound of my heartbeat?
Not at all, no. So we're just getting data from changes in your heart rate as it's increasing and decreasing, and we're using those increases and decreases, to modulate soundscapes, so the frequencies of the sounds and mixing between different samples. So it's like a big mixing desk that's being controlled by data about changes in your heart rhythm.
Okay.
Hmm.
So is my heart going fast or slow?
You can hear it beating there. It's quite slow by the sounds of it, and it's got quite a lot of variation we can hear in that beat. We're analysing the last 127 heartbeats, and every time there's a heartbeat, we kind of move that forward along. So looking backwards in time for these changes. So it's a very slow interaction. And if we go up here, we'll start to see some patterns soon. We're measuring... I want to see here. Yeah, so in a moment, when it's got 127 beats, we'll start to see these patterns. And these patterns are what is going to be controlling the sound. So scientifically, we're doing a spectrum analysis of changes in heart rate. And we're looking for what's called a resonance, where instead of being a complicated waveform, it becomes very simple, a simple waveform, like going up and down very rhythmically. And that's usually in time of your breathing. So we find in many forms of meditation, breath normally falls down to around 6 breaths per minute.
I am finding that this is kind of making me think a lot more about my breath and like actively, like, is it going too fast? Is it going too slow?
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting phenomena with technology and medical technologies in particular. We're used to being kind of judged and assessed, and I think that's a challenge for artists working with this technology around how to support people to have other ways of experiencing that technology. So this is really not so much about being diagnosed, but just to experience your body and to explore your body, not in such a medicalized way. What we're seeing on the screen here, we can see these patterns, and there's these bands of activity, and this is a very low frequency changes, low frequency and high frequency. And what we're going to do is see if we can shift that towards low frequency. So what I want to just check is...
Does that mean affecting my actual heartbeat?
Yeah, you're going to influence your heart rate with these changes.
So the sound is based off my heartbeat, but then the sound can also be used to change my heartbeat.
Yeah, exactly.
So crazy. Yeah.
Yes, it's a feedback loop. So let's just see if we can... I want to bring these other sounds in.
Is that like a digital sampler or something that you're using there?
Yeah, I put my own samplers in here. The sounds like we're wearing the sounds on changes in our nervous system. And I was interested with Gail to experiment with quite dark, almost abrasive, edgy colours, but wearing them on a relaxed state. And so what is it like to... feel through these sounds in this state? And now exhale for me again, just blowing out through your lips. So the sounds are swelling and rising and falling gently with your inhalation and exhalation, and as your breathing slows down, that rise and fall, changes in the heart rate, becomes more pronounced.
Installation Matematic is part of a Sounding the Future exhibition at the University of Technology, Sydney, and is open until September the 22nd. And that means we're out of time. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You've been listening to Panacea on 107.3. I'm Quentin Strawley. Coming up next is a question of balance, so the programmes continue. Stay tuned. Have a really good week, and let's catch up next Tuesday night.